Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri. And joining me again is Bill Zahner, who's from San Diego State University. He's in the math department there. He's also the director of the Center for Research in Mathematics and Science Education. Bill, thanks for being back here on the podcast.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I always think fondly of you because you were the first official guest on the Math Ed Podcast back in 2012, if you remember that.
Oh my gosh, I do remember that. I think we were in a meeting room at a conference. That's what I remember.
Yep. And I was kind of nervous about it because I had this idea and podcasts were still relatively new at that time. And I said, hey, Bill, you don't really know me very well, but I have this idea. And you were very gracious and said, let's go for it. Let's do it. And now it's 10 years later, almost.
That's incredible. How many episodes are you up to?
Oh, man, 160 something. I have a spreadsheet that keeps track of them somewhere. And I know you've been back before, too, in 2015. I think we talked about some slope concepts.
That's right. The rise and run of a procedural approach to slope. Still, like that title.
Well, we're here to talk about a little bit of a different topic this time, Bill. So you published an article in Teachers College Record. And I basically just was really desperate to talk to you about this article because it came out in 2019, but myself, my colleagues were thinking about these ideas right now still. So I thought, hey, I can pick Bill's brain about it a little bit. So this article is in Teachers College Record. It's called Examining the Recruitment, Placement, and Career Trajectories of Secondary Mathematics Teachers Prepared for High Needs Schools. And that was written with Suzanne Chapin, Rich Levine, Ling Jun He, and Robert Alfonso. That was in 2019 that you published that, Bill, looking at teacher recruitment and retention, especially in high-need schools. And I know that was a challenge then. It feels like it's still a challenge now in 2021. Like, what is your thought about the situation for teacher recruitment and retention these days?
Yeah, I think much of what we said, and really that paper was published in 2019, which means that the research was taking place in the years prior to that. And just a personal vignette, I think this paper was accepted the day or day after my youngest child was born. So I always have a way of gauging how long ago that was based on my child's age.
Yeah.
I think the situation has essentially stayed the same or become even more acute in some ways. So the current mid-pandemic or near the end of the pandemic job market, I think, has become even more compressed in the sense that many, many teachers who were near retirement appear to be retiring, and there are quite a few open positions. So at least in our local school districts, this is a tight labor market across the board now, actually, not simply in STEM or science or special education, which historically have always been the areas where there's always been a shortage. Now, I think that maybe these same pressures are applying across the board in every content area. So that's one update on the situation now.
Yeah, it feels that way here in Missouri as well, that the challenges a couple years ago have gotten even more acute, like you said. And the fact that other subject areas are having a real need to hire teachers as well makes it where if somebody wanted to be a teacher, but they weren't sure what subject area to do, they now kind of have their pick, right? I can almost go to any subject area and probably have good job prospects. Whereas before we used to sort of say like, hey, math has the best job prospects if you want to pick a subject area. So that's trickier now. And then in your study, you're also dealing with people who have, like mathematics degrees, or they have sort of other professional opportunities besides education, and you're trying to sort of recruit them and support them into education. And the general job market, to me, also probably makes that more challenging because there are a lot of industries and a lot of companies that are trying to hire math folks, and they're raising the salaries, signing bonuses, and they're doing all these things to try to attract math people into those industries, which seems like that makes it even harder to try to get them into education.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I have to say, one thing that I think is working in the advantage of education is that there are a large number, at least the folks that I work with, a large number of students who I work with, prospective teachers, who are really dedicated to working with other students, to teaching as a craft or as a profession. I remain hopeful on one level that I think that there's a value to teaching that is seen by a number of prospective teachers beyond simply the dollars and cents. So it's still hard to argue with dollars and cents, but I think that it's important to also think about that there's some real benefits to teaching as a career pathway that, I think we sometimes undersell. We try to look at the purely material outcome. So that's just something I've been noticing as well as kind of a counterweight to that. But without a doubt, the market currently is extremely tight, and many people graduating, especially with a STEM degree, have a lot of job prospects to work from. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reality.
Right. No, but you're right. The pandemic has revealed some of the importance of schools in the community and of teachers in supporting young people. And when teachers go through such a grind and so much stress and pressure, it also does sometimes clarify their purpose, and they sort of see like, no, I can see what I'm doing, why I'm here for these kids. And so, yeah, I think there is that side of it too. But let's get into the study a little bit more. Like, what would you say was the particular goal or purpose of the Teachers College Record study?
So the main goal was to understand how the various program structures led to the outcomes that we were thinking of, or to understand that system better, right? So the fundamental problem has always been, we want to get folks to teach math in particular schools that are considered hard to staff. And there are various ways that we as educators have approached that problem or that challenge, right? One way that we have approached that challenge is by offering incentives like scholarships. The other things that we've done is try to ease the entry into the field of teaching through, for example, alternative certification programs. And so we wanted to just make sense of this system. And this study grew out of perhaps a somewhat opportunistic setting that I was working at BU at the time. And at BU, we were supporting both three NOICE programs, which are scholarship programs to recruit, educate, and place STEM majors, people with STEM majors, to be teachers. And we also were supporting the local chapter of Teach for America by providing the coursework that the TFA core members needed to be licensed to teach in Massachusetts. There was this amazing opportunity to look at these two different models and, you know, make some more generalizable inferences or understandings. And this is against the backdrop. There were a number of studies about, say, like the New York City Teaching Core, I think it's called, or Teaching Fellows, and a few other alternative certification programs, and that the NOICE scholarship program from the National Science Foundation was at that time just getting really interested in the research track to understand kind of the impact of their programs. And so we took advantage of that opportunity and kind of brought the resources and the setting together to investigate these questions. And so, you know, the questions in some ways were pretty simple, but we wanted to understand, you know, what are the, you know, the characteristics of folks in each pathway? What are their career trajectories? And then how does those career trajectories relate to what we know from the literature, or we can hypothesize from the literature, things that might lead to various career trajectories, like specifically teachers' impressions of the working conditions at the schools where they're placed.
So with that setup, I wonder if you can just maybe make sure listeners have at least a basic understanding of the NOICE scholarship program. Like, how does that actually work? And then Teach for America, you know, people either know about it or they've at least heard about it. But what are the sort of details that we should make sure we understand to be able to interpret your study?
Good question. So the NOICE scholarship program is actually a really massive scholarship. I shouldn't say massive. It's a substantial scholarship program sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And the scholarship program provides financial support for students who have a STEM major to teach mathematics or science. And typically the funding comes from the federal government through the NOICE scholarship program, which is through the National Science Foundation, but then is distributed to institutions of higher education who run various teacher education programs. So
it's the NOICE scholars, the NOICE scholars are kind of going through a sort of like a traditional university preparation program, but they have this scholarship support that is backing them.
Exactly. Right. And so it's a distributed model in the sense that each university implements their NOICE program kind of tailored to their local context. The common denominator is that the individuals who receive the scholarship get some kind of funding or scholarship to support their education, whether it's a tuition waiver, a small living stipend, or some combination thereof. In the NOICE scholarship program, the NOICE scholars commit to teach in a high need school for 2 years. And that definition of high need comes from a federal law describing schools that have either a high proportion of low socioeconomic status students, a high number of teachers who are teaching out of their preparation area, or a relatively high rate of teacher turnover. So the NOI scholars commit to teaching in a high need school for 2 years. And then when they've fulfilled that teaching requirement, their scholarship is fulfilled. The obligation is fulfilled. Teach for America is an alternative certification program. I think it's been around now for over 25 years, I believe. And it's run with a national office. And then there are kind of regional hubs of TFA. You know, their model is to recruit individuals and place them as teachers in schools serving students from poverty. And I believe they are the largest alternative certification program in the country. The model of TFA actually has evolved over the years, from my understanding. But when we were there in Boston, the TFA office of Greater Boston was placing teachers at local schools in the Boston area. And then they were partnering up with Boston University to fulfill the state licensure requirements. The model of TFA is to recruit folks and then to do a summer workshop or a summer intensive professional development. And then they are provided with a temporary license, the TFA core members. And then over the course of their first year of teaching, they actually take coursework in addition to teaching in order to fulfill the legal requirements for their licensure. And at BEU, we also offered the opportunity for TFA core members to stay on for a second year after they'd completed their licensure requirements in order to get a master's degree. Both TFA and NOIS have like a model of providing some kind of professional development or professional support for teachers in the field. And with TFA, I think it may have been slightly more structured because it was through TFA that all of the professional development or a great deal of professional development was provided and coaching. Where NOIS was, because folks had gone through a traditional teacher prep program and were at various school districts and all over the state, there was ongoing professional development, but it was more come together on a Saturday or on a weekend night and discuss an aspect of teaching and check in and so on. So slightly different models, but both of them meant to kind of build and sustain a community as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the study, you have data that is from the teacher participants. I wonder if you could just quickly give us kind of the elements of data that you were able to use for this study.
So the main data that we collected were administrative records from both the NOIS and TFA programs, which gave us some background on the individuals who were recruited into the two pathways. And then we administered a survey to all of the folks who were in those two pathways. And so I think the total number of participants was 158. When we kind of identified the universe of potential participants, 48 of those were NOIS supported teachers and 110 were TFA supported teachers. And then we sent out a survey to all of the participants, and the survey had kind of multiple elements to it. And we gave folks a small little gift card as an incentive to respond. We got 100% response rate from the NOIS fellows because they had agreed to do so. So that was nice. And from the TFA folks, we had a lower response rate. I don't have the exact number in front of me. I think it was 48 or so. Part of the reason that we had a lower response rate was because many of the TFA folks had already actually left the field of teaching by the time our study started. So we had records on them because they had been part of TFA's database, but they had already moved on to other parts of their lives and were not responding to our survey.
Speaking with Bill Zahner from San Diego State University about his article in Teachers College Record. So now I just want to ask you, what were some of the main findings or themes that came out from the data from the NOIS scholars, the NOIS supported program?
So perhaps not surprisingly, 100% of the NOIS scholars had an undergraduate STEM major using the NSF definition of STEM. And that is relevant perhaps in contrast with the TFA group, but it's an important piece to note that the NOIS scholarship program was successful at recruiting folks who have STEM majors and getting them into the teacher preparation pathway. The NOIS scholars were more likely to persist in teaching beyond their original 2-year commitment. And that was an exciting finding, or a finding that seemed intriguing to us. And we actually ran a survival analysis in order to kind of make sense of this. So one of the issues is that when you're looking at these data, if people are still working, you don't have like a good understanding of how to quantify that. And so working with the statisticians was helpful because they were able to help us apply slightly more sophisticated analysis. So like after we accounted for school level data about student SES and student STEM major identifier, the risk of discontinuing in teaching for TFA was 5.1 times as large as for the noise group. And so that was, for us, a pretty significant finding.
Right.
They also worked at schools that were slightly less high needs. I don't know if that's a word. But if you look, for example, at the percent of students who qualified for free and reduced price lunch, the noise scholars worked at a larger range of schools. And that was one of the important, I think, findings or insights that we had. But all of this is moderated by one really important thing, which is that the NOICE program appeared to be very successful at identifying and recruiting folks who wanted to be teachers, as just folks with STEM majors who wanted to be teachers, and getting them to work in high-need schools. But we hypothesized that without the NOICE program, a number of those folks would have still become teachers based on their responses to a survey question, which said, you know, would you become a teacher without this program? And the answer was basically yes. But then there was, would you become a teacher in a high need school without this program? And the answer was maybe. So we think that the NOICE program succeeded in its goal of recruiting folks with STEM majors to then subsequently teach in high needs educational settings. Mm-hmm. That might be the kind of the big takeaway that I would say there.
Right. So clearly some successes for the NOICE program, but some of it might be that they were taking the low hanging fruit. Like they're kind of just getting the people that were already leaning towards that teacher pathway already. But locking them in with a commitment is still probably a good thing. And then like you're saying here, when it got them in the teacher pathway, it kind of oriented some of them towards the high needs schools instead of just where else they might have gone in their teaching career.
Yeah, and I think that that's the main, for me, the main takeaway, that it did, and actually I would actually say it was a little more confidence that it did actually get folks who otherwise would not be working in high need schools to go work in high need schools. And you know, there's a lot of research that teachers often teach at sometimes the very school they attended, but you know, within a certain very small radius from their home. So this may have succeeded in getting some folks who would have returned to, say, the suburbs of Boston to actually go work in the city of Boston with a different student population and a really different school characteristic.
Now, you have alluded to some Teach for America things by way of contrast or comparison, but is there anything else that you sort of, that was noteworthy in your analysis from the Teach for America teachers?
Probably the most important thing was that TFA succeeded in recruiting a more diverse group of teachers. And for this, you know, I definitely think of an old paper by Danny Martin talking about what does it mean to be highly qualified? And I think that's a really important question, right? So often in the world of teacher recruitment and retention, we think of things that are easy to measure, like, you know, whether or not you have a STEM degree. But I think there's other really important dimensions to this. And, you know, one that strikes me as super important is the personal identity and characteristics of the teachers themselves. So TFA was able to recruit a more diverse pool of teachers in terms of gender, race, ethnicity. I guess we didn't ask about language background. Now, if I did the study again, I'd ask about that. And that strikes me as very important given the demographics of the schools that are called high need schools, which serve overwhelmingly students from minoritized communities. So that was an important, I think, asset of the TFA program. The TFA program was also more likely to recruit folks who would not teach otherwise. So on that same survey question, you know, would you become a teacher without your entry pathway? Mm-hmm. The answer was much less likely to be yes for the TFA teachers. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, the ones who persisted, I think, were more likely to say yes. So there is this kind of interesting dilemma mm-hmm. here, but there was a marginal piece where I think maybe some folks who would not otherwise consider teaching considered teaching because they joined this alternative pathway. So that's for us, one of the interesting findings there.
Right. And then there's this question, and it came up at the PM&A conference that we hosted in St. Louis, or Bill Tate was there. This question of, okay, you recruit somebody to be a teacher, but they only teach for 2 or 3 years. Sometimes people think, oh, that's a failure, right? They didn't stay in the profession for 10 years or 15 years or whatever. But I think it was Bill Tate, but it was definitely part of the conversation, was saying, like, we actually might need to think about those differently. We might need to think that for those 2 years, they helped that school. They worked with, you know, dozens or hundreds of students. And so that might be actually a success to have them taught for 2 or 3 years. And that we shouldn't just say the only thing that's successful is if they teach for the rest of their life, you know, like,
right.
So,
right.
And especially if it's recruiting somebody that would not have taught, then to get 2 or 3 years might have actually
maybe
might have been a victory in some point of view.
Yeah. And I have to say, I'm not sold on that, but I'm trying to be.
Oh, like, yeah, no, I'm just saying and I'm not arguing one way or the other. I'm just saying it actually is kind of a point of discussion about to what extent or for what type of teacher are we thankful for the 2 years. I mean, there might be a certain kind of teacher where you're not thankful for the 2 years.
one really important finding that, you know, I would love people to think about is, as I was writing this paper, I also thought of this from the perspective, like, various stakeholders and their perspectives. So one really important stakeholder to think about is the school principal. For the school principal, there's both a cost and a benefit to having someone come in and teach, but then leave after 2 years, right? So the benefit is you fill one of your positions. And, you know, I knew a lot of the participants because I taught courses in the program, right? So these are people I know. They are generally really dedicated individuals. There's a disruption when someone leaves after 2 years, in the sense that now you need to go find someone else to fill that slot. And that's a real challenge. And also a lot of the professional development that you put into forming that teacher is now lost, right? That human capital is lost. So from the perspective of a school building principal, I really want folks to take away this idea that they should think about forming relationships with the teacher preparation programs in order to help them kind of build the team, if you will, right? So a strategic principal will think about, I want to build a department of, you know, teachers who have particular characteristics or strengths, and kind of, maybe this metaphor of a sports team is a little bit too far, but, you know, you want to fill your positions and really get this team together. And so that's something that I think is really important to not overlook, because oftentimes when we as researchers or teacher educators focus on programs like the NOICE program, we're thinking about it as our throughput, or like our preparation and placement of teachers. But we aren't necessarily taking that same perspective, we, the researchers or teacher educators, as the school principal. So that's something that came out as highly relevant as I was doing this work. And, you know, on a personal level, like, my sister is a school principal, and I mentioned the NOICE program and she'd never heard of it, right? And there was one in her region. And I think that's maybe just an interesting thing that I want to hope put on more people's radar, that this is a potential way to start building up school staffs through building partnerships, university and school or district partnerships. And I think actually that's a strength of TFA. And I think one of their models is really working with schools or school systems or charter networks on a similar model. So I would love to see the NOICE programs have a similar kind of networking model, and they're thinking about a holistic system rather than kind of individuals fulfilling their requirements. That's my one preachy answer there.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you one more question sort of along that same line. Like, what else is kind of on your mind, or what kind of new insights have come to you because of having carried out this analysis, you know, kind of pulling back like you're doing now to sort of, like, what are some of the broader thoughts that you have about this situation?
So, I mean, the most basic is that I think teacher recruitment and preparation and retention is not something that's going to be solved either by the university, you know, by the university or the alternative prep programs or so on individually. It's going to be solved as a system. I am really deeply curious about the various alternative models that are out there right now for teacher preparation and placement. I hope that we and the university side who are working, you know, both you and I are coming from kind of a traditional university perspective, are able to learn from the various models out there. I think that that's a really important thing to do. I'm excited by the NOICE program supporting more research in this area. And I believe there's a track in the NOICE kind of RFP, the request for proposals, for more research-oriented studies. So this study, I think, I hope it's useful for the field in the sense that this provides a model for one study that we did. Mm-hmm. There are many others that you could do collecting other types of data and asking different types of questions. But I'm really curious to learn more about how we can really support, you know, more teachers to be effective, and particularly serving students, you know, who will greatly benefit from having, you know, highly prepared teachers working with them. Mm-hmm. That's one thing, I think. And then maybe the last thing I'll say is that it does get me thinking hard about how to diversify the pool of teachers we get into the NOICE programs. In some ways, it's an artifact because the NOICE program is so regionalized, because it's each individual school. It might be somewhat mediated through the university you're working at, right? But that's a really important thing. And I think, you know, just for me as an advisor, I advise undergraduates among the many hats that I wear. Mm-hmm. When I tell them, hey, there's a scholarship that could pay for you to get your credential, they say, oh my gosh, there is? So I think really shouting from the rooftops what we're doing in the NOICE programs, the opportunities that are there, is so important, because although it feels like, you know, the people running these programs, and I've been in that seat, like you feel like this is all you do all day long. It's amazing how much more outreach we could do to kind of raise the awareness of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for your work on that. And Bill, I always, as you know, you've been here a couple times before, I like to ask just a more personal question at the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you said, we're pretty far into a pandemic. Hopefully we're nearing more the late stages of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you've taken up any new hobbies, or if you've like developed any new skills during the pandemic. I know you're big into cycling. Like, have you had opportunities for cycling in some form during the pandemic, or what have you been up to?
When I was working from home, I got back on the bike, kind of like getting back on the horse, I guess. So I was able to do a lot more cycling, which was really fun. And that's something I'm hoping to sustain. I also picked up running, which I have never done before. And I found that was, as long as I don't run too hard, I think I tried in the past and always injured myself, but I realized maybe I've gotten a little wiser. I don't need to push myself to the extreme limit every time I exercise. That's been something. And the last one, my family and I, we decided to try to take up some serious baking. I'm married to a really good baker. But last year we decided to make a couple of, holiday, you know, cakes and so on that were extremely complicated. And it was surprisingly a very enjoyable way to spend 2 days in the kitchen trying to make a recipe that's just way beyond your capabilities, just to see what turns out.
Yeah, I guess it's like
that show nailed it, right? Like, it's like this, let's see how this goes. And oh, well, it worked out.
Yeah.
So that's been, you know, I guess take joy in those small things that we can do.
Right. Well, thanks for coming back on the podcast. And it's good talking to you, and best of luck.
Well, thank you. And thanks for having me. It's great to be here.